Hi, everybody. I'm Kelly, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July the 4th, 1998, and I do have a home group. It's the Buckingham Big Book Group. Meets down in Buckingham on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. It's open meeting, and all is welcome, so if you're ever down that way, we'd love to have you come down that way. And I do have a sponsor, and I do sponsor a couple of other ladies, and I think that that's real important for me to stay sober. So I'm just here to share in a general way what my drinking used to be like, what happened to me during that time, and what it's like today. And basically, I drank a lot for a long time. You know, that just pretty much sums it up, really. I probably need to share a little bit more than that, but anyway, I don't want to hang in the drunkalog too long. But anyway, I'm originally from Tidewater, and I'm one of six girls. My mother and father divorced when I was young. Three of them went to live with my dad, and me and two others stayed with my mom. My mom remarried a man's stepfather, and things in the household didn't used to be that very good. He did a lot of drinking and a lot of coming in and fussing and fighting and beating and banging with my mom. So needless to say, from a small child, 8 years old and on up, I just stayed in a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety. I never knew what was going to happen in that home. I just knew I just never wanted that man to come home because it was always going to be something, you know, and it was always going to end up with my mom getting a black eye or us kids crying or us having to leave in the night or the law coming or something like that. And I know that that's not what makes me alcoholic, but I'm just saying, I'm just getting started to say that that's the situation I lived in as a young child. My mom worked very hard to try to take care of us girls because he could never hold a job and he was in and out. And whenever these incidents would take place, we would travel to Lynchburg back and forth on the Greyhound bus because she was from Lynchburg. So when she couldn't pay the rent, we'd get on the Greyhound bus, we'd go up, we'd come back, we'd go up, and she'd take him back, and all of that went on and on and on. And I just remembered from a very young age that as soon as I could get out of that house, I knew I was going to get out of there. I didn't want to be there. I just couldn't stand being there. One year, I went to four different schools. In 1 year time, I think I was in the fourth grade, being the new kid. And, you know, that's not a very good place to be, you know, an adolescent age. You know, people pick on you, and you don't have the right kind of clothes, you know, the right kind of shoes, you know, all that stuff. And so I knew I hated school, and I was going to get out of there just as soon as I could, too. I know that probably early on, 8, 9, 10 years old, I'd take sips of beer that would be left around the house just because I was curious, but not, you know, like to get drunk or anything like that, but just to see. Just because I was curious, because it seemed like every time that man would drink like that, you know, things would happen or whatever. And I don't know why I was curious, but I just was, you know. But I never felt anything off of it, you know, so I couldn't understand why he acted like that. But anyway, I had a couple of younger sisters, and there'd be many nights, you know, when those things would go on. We didn't have a telephone, and I'd have to put, you know, them out of the window to go up to the 7-Eleven. To call the police so somebody could come, you know, to straighten that out. And I remember hating that man for a long time, even after I got into sobriety. And I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I know for a fact that, you know, he died of a mad dog alcoholic death in his van out in Houston, Texas, with nothing but liquor bottles around him, and they found him dead. And he'd been there about 3 days. And they found the Serenity card in his pocket. And I know that he'd tried to go to the VA because my mama had told me and stuff and everything. And, you know, today I look on that now, you know, like I don't hate him anymore. And I'm just very sorry that he couldn't have made it here, you know. Because I used to be told that he was a good man at one time, you know, and that he was a decent person and wasn't always the way he was. And, you know, I'm just sorry that he had to die like that. Anyway, so coming up, my mom worked as a waitress a whole lot, and he was gone a whole lot. And my real father's retired from the military, lived over in Virginia Beach. I lived with my mother in Hampton, and I pretty much got to run the streets pretty much. She had to work, couldn't afford a babysitter. Well, not for me anyway, but she had somebody that would babysit the younger sisters. And so 11, 12, 13 years old, you know, there I am. And, you know, would stay out late and ride my bike and go and play in the woods and just do whatever and just came in when I wanted to. And I just love that. I just love that feeling of being free. I just love just, you know, no noise going on in the house, and I could do what I wanted to do. And, you know, a little bit later on when I was in the sixth grade, going into the seventh grade, I never really fitted in with the good kids at school or the athletes or the yuppies, and I never really fit in with the cool kids either. And one day, around lunchtime, me and this other girl was hanging out together. I didn't have a lot of friends, but I had this one other girl, Carol, and these three boys, and they wanted to go out at lunch and go back in the woods and skip school and, excuse me, not come back. And they had some bottles of wine. They had some Mad Dog 2020 and some Boone's Farm, and they invited us. And that's what I was curious about, and that's what I wanted. I wanted to feel a part of. Not so much about what they were going to do. I'd heard and seen, you know, going out in the woods and all. It's just, God, you know, these older boys was inviting us back there, you know, and that was what drew me in, you know. And we got back there, and they passed the bottle around, and when it got to me, I just started chug-a-lugging it. And this one little kid just pulled it back from me, you know, and he said, if you want your own, you go to the Revco up here and steal your own. Because it wasn't like I just took a sip. But I remember it like yesterday, and what I remember was it made me feel very warm inside. It made me feel very calm inside. And it made me be able to talk to these kids out there, and I just felt okay. I don't know how to explain it, you know. I mean, it was just, I didn't have all that knot and that anxiety and that fear and that scaredness, you know. It just kind of soothed it, man. It just did. And we went and got more, and we hung out. And I come home that evening with, had smoked marijuana, drunk, and had a hickey on my neck all in one day. All these things happen. And my stepfather was there when I got there, and he told my mom, you know, she's been drinking, she's drunk, and, you know, I was sick, I was puking so bad, this red stuff, you know, just, oh, it was just awful. And I just told, you know, my mom was so gullible, bless her heart, and she still is today, really, an enabler and all, and she just believed it was something that I'd eaten. And I told him I fell in the rose bush on the bicycle when it fell over, and that's why I had the hickey on the neck, and she believed all of that, but he won't have none of it. Stayed home from school on Thursday, sick as a dog. But come Friday morning, buddy, I could not wait to get back to that school. I could not wait to get back there and to get with those kids. And from that point on until I was 36 years old, that's what I ran after. I ran after not so much in the beginning of the alcohol, but just wanting to be wild, wanting to be free, and wanted to be a part of this group of people that seemed like that they had it together, and they liked me, and they wanted me around. And then, of course, all those other things were there, and they were free, you know, and I got to take part of, you know, the alcohol and all the other stuff. And I just loved it. I loved riding around in cars and hitchhiking rides and going to the beach and lying to my mom and spending the night out and saying I was with another girl. And just in the beginning, it was just, it was really a lot of fun. If all I had to do was just throw up a little bit to feel the wantedness rather than the rejectedness, and to have this, I was willing to do that. And that's what I did, you know, that's what I did, that's what I chased for a long time. And I don't want to be all around everywhere tonight, but, you know, during this period of time, as I started skipping school a lot, and back then they would call the truant officers to come and pick you up if they seen you walking down the road or at the beach or whatever, and so I'd get picked up and have to go to Hampton Juvenile Detention Center and, you know, staying out all night long. One night a couple of us got drunk and I thought I was going to hitchhike to California. And so got on 64 down there by the Coliseum and made it up near Richmond when we got pulled over. And that was as far as I ever made getting it to California. And back to the detention center I went. And then I was beyond, you know, they took out the petition of beyond parental control. And then I got sent up to Bon Air Juvenile Detention Center in Richmond for girls. So that just, you know, I was going to do, I just had a very bad attitude that I was going to do whatever I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. And nobody was going to tell me what to do. Not the law, not my mother, not my father, not, you know. I just had this big chip on my shoulders at 12, 13 years old that, you know, life had dealt me this bad card, and I was just going to do whatever it took for me to get whatever it was that I needed. And I didn't care what it cost. I didn't care what it cost you, my family, you know, my self-worth or anything. Anyway, during that time, my mother made another trip back to Lynchburg, and somehow I conned her into letting me stay down in Hampton. And I stayed with a friend of hers that she didn't realize was doing things, but she was, so that was just cool. I stayed with that woman and her daughter and started going over to Norfolk and into the after-hour bars and hanging out with a lot of Navy people and doing a lot of drinking and going into clubs over there. And, you know, once again, was with some people older than me. I had fake IDs going into bars, and these people were, you know, 21, 22, 23, whatever they were, Navy guys going in, you know, and our thing, a couple of us girls, was to go into the bar and talk to them and try to get their money and, you know, promise different things. And then when we come outside, the guys would beat them up and roll them and take the money. You know, and I'm not proud of that, but that's just what I would do. And we would do that so we could get the money to get the motel, to sleep all day, to go back to do that stuff that night. And that's what I did. I drove some guy's car, a Cobra 2, Mustang 2, down Little Creek Road while he was working one day, no license. Ran into the back of a car at a red light, crashed it, got out, jumped, left the car there. Ran to some place and used the phone to call my dad and asked my dad if he'd give me money to give me so I could get on the Greyhound bus to go back to Lynchburg. And he was more than willing to give me the money to go to Lynchburg. He hated for me to be down there. He could not control me. You know, me and my father had had a really bad relationship for a really, really long time. So I ended up back in Lynchburg. And my mother was living in a little trailer park up here in Lynchburg, and I did the same thing. You know, I came up there. She worked. My sisters were a little bit older. I'd watch them and meet people in the trailer park, start drinking, start partying, and doing the same thing. And the next thing I knew, I found myself pregnant at 17. And, you know, here I am. You know, I've done quit school, and I'm 17, and I'm pregnant. And the guy that I was pregnant by, I thought, you know, he told me, he said, I always thought it was just going to be me and you trying to make it. I never figured on a kid. And so he'd come around or whatever. And anyway, I moved back to Hampton. I started doing the same thing like my mom, you know. So I came back to Hampton and I had my son. And this is how it went pretty much. I worked at bars that paid me under the table so I could get welfare checks. My mom would watch my son because by that time she'd gotten back down there. And I'd go, she'd watch him. I'd get off from work at a bar, stay out all night, sleep all day, and pretty much just do that. Never had insurance on my car, so I had a lot of suspended driver's license because I could never pay the insurance. Would leave my son, tell my mom I'd be back in an hour, and never could make it back. To this day, she'll tell me, oh, you remember that time you set Ryan over the fence and just said, see you later, I'm going to school to get my GED. And I was gone. You know, just I would just do stupid stuff, you know, but my mom always took care of him. And I pretty much just lived like that. I lived on welfare, bartended, stayed drunk, stayed out all night long, did some other things. And for me, when I mentioned that, that was just to enhance my drinking. I know to my core I'm an alcoholic. I know that when I take one drink, I don't know how many I'm going to take, but it ain't going to be one, and I've never wanted one. So I know if I stay away from the first drink, I'm probably not going to have the second drink, but I'm probably also not going to do those other things. I've never been one that just woke up and went and did all the other stuff that people talk about, you know. Only after I was under the influence of alcohol. And those things just helped me to either slow my drinking down or to speed it up, just depending on how late it was and where I was and what I needed to do. And I just love to drink. I love to drink, and I love to drink and go out and dance. And I was a disco duck queen, and I just loved going to do all them things. I just loved it, you know. And things started getting pretty bad down in Hampton, and my son was getting ready to turn 5. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, his father had been calling saying he wanted to be a father and he was going to do all these things and for me to come back to Lynchburg. So I came back to Lynchburg, and that lasted about 2 or 3 months. And then when I seen what the real deal was, you know, and he didn't want to be a father. He just wanted to do all these other things. I didn't want any other part of him. So there I was in Lynchburg, the streets rolled up at 12 o'clock at night, and there ain't no disco bars, you know, there's a Sheraton, and that's about it, and you have a lot of rinky-dink bars where you go shoot pool, country music, and drink beer. But that's okay, because as long as I can drink, I can fit into that. I can fit in just about everywhere I go, and I can meet up with people everywhere I go. You know, if I want to drink and do the things, you know, that I'm used to doing. I just might have to do them in a different atmosphere, but it's the same thing to me. I've had 5 DUIs. I'm just going to speed it up. I've had 5 DUIs. I've been convicted of 3 of them. I've been put on probation for welfare because I thought I could work and get checks and not report it, because I always thought you owed me something. And I never really wanted to work for a living. I always worked underneath the table, wherever it was, so I could get these checks and get the money over here and work on the side. And, you know, whoever I was seeing at the same, at whatever time, they would give me the money. You know, and I always thought that I was going to raise my son totally different than the way that I was raised. And that would be that he would go to the same elementary school, the same middle school, and the same high school, and he would have the clothes, and he would have the shoes, and he was going to have those things, no matter what it took for me to for him to have them. And he did. And later on, you know, in inventory and through this program and getting with the sponsor, you know, he had all them things, but it wasn't because of any decent, good deed I did from working a job or anything. It was all from ill-gotten gains or from other people's charity, other people's money, and stuff like that. And I'm getting ahead of myself, of which I'm making restitution for still today. I have a lot of financial amends that I still have to make. And that, you know, I mean, I would put myself in a lot of really bad circumstances out there drinking and driving, even with my son in the car. And I would run with a lot of people that were not very good people, you know, and I would rip them off, and there'd be consequences for that. And I just put myself and my son at risk a lot of times, you know, not really meaning to, but just because self-will run riot, Kelly was going to do it her way, you know, not thinking of other people's welfare. And I want to share this one thing, and it's not really an outside issue. It's got something to do with my son. But one time we were looking for an apartment, because I'm always getting kicked out and can't pay the rent, and looking for an apartment when I can't work because I spend it all on alcohol and everything else, and, you know, going buying the booze and buying the clothes, and then I don't pay the rent. But so we were riding through this little complex, and I was looking at this apartment, and I was driving really slow, and I had my son in the front seat, and he was probably about 9 or 10, you know. And like I said, he'd been staying with different babysitters and different people for me to go out, and I didn't know what was taking place in those homes. But anyway, I slammed into the back of a parked car, and his head hit the window, and when he did, you know, he just held his eyes, started crying, and he opened up the door immediately and jumped out and started jumping around. And, of course, you know, I'm freaking out. I get out. The law's called. People are coming outside, you know, and they get him to the hospital, and he's on this stretcher back there, and I'm all screwed up from drinking and doing a bunch of Xanaxes and all of that stuff. And I get back there at the emergency room, and that boy looked at me, and he told me, he said, "Mama," he said, "I know if I gotta die, I'm going to heaven." And now it just floored me, and I was like, hey, everything's going to be all right. She ain't going to die. It's just a little glass. Everything's okay, you know. Don't worry. Don't talk like that, you know. But he looked at me because I guess he was scared, and he didn't know what was going on with him, but he said that to me. And later on, you know, after we got through that, this lady, Charlotte, that used to babysit him or keep him with her son, I told her about that experience, and she said, yeah, Kelly, yeah, he knew where he was going. Because I've been taking him to church on Sunday, and he knew all about that. And I guess in that moment, he believed it or he knew it. And I was just like, man, whoa, you know, somebody else is teaching my child, you know. But thank God for her, and thank God for these male mentors, because my son would stay in a whole lot of after-school activities, you know, whether it be soccer or karate or Boy Scouts or whatever, and all of that was so I could go to happy hour and do. But he was involved in them, in a, you know, because he come from a single parent home, and those men that took care of him, and you know, a lot of times I'd come to pick him up drunk, and they never said nothing to my knowledge bad about me in front of him. You know, they would always still talk nice and treat me nice or bring him home. You know, and I mean, that's really cool. I owe a lot of debt and gratitude to that because I know that a lot of that has made him the man that he is today. And it wasn't by my doings, but in other words, I believe God looks out for drunks and fools and kids. And he did, and he really did, you know, and I really appreciate that if any of y'all do that. So anyway, that's how my life pretty much was. I've had guns held to my head. I've had so many things happen so that I could continue to get my way, so that I could drink, so I could buy things, so I wouldn't have to work, so I could pretend like I was this other person, because I never wanted to be who I was. When I would go out and drink or I didn't have a job, you know, people would say, well, how do you get your money or what do you do? And I always say, I have this trust fund from this family. They won't like that. What am I going to do? Sit up there and tell them I'm going with men, I'm getting welfare and welfare fraud and money under I mean, you know, we all say, you know, we sit at these bars and we, I don't know about y'all, but I conjured up a whole lot of stuff. You know, I mean, I really did, you know, everything but the truth. But anyway, my life was really going down the tubes and going down the tubes fast. I started getting DUIs. I started going to jail a weekend here, a couple of weekends there, getting tags. In North Carolina, tags back then, it didn't coincide with Virginia, so you could go there and get a license and get tags, did that. I was above the law, and I wasn't going to quit driving. I was never one to give my keys over when I was drinking. I mean, I wanted to be able to go when I wanted to go, you know. Nothing was going to hold me back. And my aunt would watch him while I would supposedly be going somewhere for a weekend, but nobody ever told him the truth about where I really was, you know, and stuff. And anyway, at the end of my drinking, I was drinking a half a gallon a day. This would be my drinking routine. I would get up in the morning and I'd drink beer or red eye. By lunchtime, I'd start drinking a couple of mixed drinks and some wine. And then I worked at the Elks Lodge. So when I got there, that's a men's club. And they did not care if the bartender drank behind the bar as long as you didn't get out of the way. And, I mean, we poured some strong drinks. I mean, you know, you had the regular little glasses like that, and they were filled up other than a splash of what you had. And they didn't care if you drank as long as you didn't get out of the way and do anything. So, I mean, I pretty much stayed drunk every day for, you know, every day. And this one man would come in and would play cards, and I never seen him drink. He'd just get a Coke here and there. And he'd come in and he'd play cards, and I'd cash his chips in for him. And He just out of the blue told me one night when I was cashing the chips in, he said, "Kelly, me and my wife would love to take you to an AA meeting some night." And I said, "Well, what is that?" And he said, "Well, it's this meeting that I go to over here for where people don't drink." And I was like, I said, "Well, RC, why would I want to go to that?" And he said, "Well, I'm just throwing it out there for you, you know, that you might want to just, you know." And 2 weeks later, there my name is up on TV again, because in Lynchburg they put your name up on TV for the DUI, you know, and here I've been gotten another one, but why would I want to go to the AA meeting, you know? It's crazy. So my last big spree was I worked there, and I closed the place down at night, and I sat drink in hand with a couple of other guys there that was telling me some things about a woman that used to date the man that I'm married to now. He used to come in there occasionally too, but he's not an alcoholic, but that's where I met him. And I will say, if your mother tells you you can't meet a good man in a bar, they're wrong, because I got one. But he's not alcoholic, but I did meet him in this place. But these people were telling me, because he's older, he's 20 years older than me, and a lot of people knew him and this woman that he had dated for years, and I'd been drinking, and they were telling me about this Linda, and blah, 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 blah. And so I went home to cook a spaghetti dinner and wait for him, but I had a few drinks, and I went to work out at this gym, and I come home, and I made the spaghetti dinner, and when he came, I started asking questions, because I talk a lot when I'm drinking, a lot. And I'm very much in your face when I talk a lot. And he said, "Kelly, I'm not listening to you tonight." He said, "I'm just going to go on home. You stay here. I'm going to go home." And I said, "What about the spaghetti dinner?" He said, "I don't give a crap about that. I don't want to hear it tonight. I'm going home and you stay here." And when he left, my mind said, "I'll fix you," which is what I've done throughout my whole life. Anytime you've done something to me, I will fix you. I will get you back if you step on my toes. I will retaliate every time. So many times. I mean, you know, I can think I got a relationship with you and we've only went out one night, and I will pop every tire on your truck when you don't answer that phone. I'm crazy. I do these things. I mean, so many things I can't even tell y'all when I'm under the influence. You know, it's just, I'm insane when I'm under the influence. So anyway, he left and I went out, and I must have looked like a pretty sight with these jogging pants on and a halter top on, and here it is January, and I go to this place called Mud Puppies in Lynchburg, and I start shooting pool, and I think I'm looking good, and I have to drink me some of these oatmeal cookie shooters and some tequila shooters, and Coors Light was my beer. So when I got done from there, I didn't want to leave, but they asked me to leave because it was closing time, and thank God they didn't call the law. But anyway, it was a $68 bar tab there. And I go and I get in this car that I'm not supposed to be driving, you know, on these tags. And my mind says, "I wonder if Linda's over there at his house." And he ain't seen this woman in years, but that's what my brain says. So I said, "I'm just going to ride over there and find out." So I go on down over there where he lived in this townhouse, and, you know, all the lights were out. There was nobody there. Of course not. He had to go to work. He was asleep. There was nobody there. So I come on back down Lakeside Drive, and the lights got in behind me. Woo, woo, woo. And then that is when everything flashed before my eyes. Because, and I mean, I don't know if y'all have had that happen to you, but I'm going to tell you, you sober up real friggin' quick. And everything before me was like, "Oh, my God, you're on this probation. You got 2 years penitentiary time hanging because of that welfare fraud. You've had all these DUIs. This guy's behind you." You know, everything. But my mind said, if I can beat him down to the quickie store before he gets me, I can get out of the car and he can't get me for a DUI. And so I tried to hurry up and get down there. And, of course, he got down there. And I pretended like I was going in the quickie store. And he tapped me on the shoulder. And back over to the car I came, and there I am. And reality set in really, really quick. And, of course, I couldn't do the field sobriety test, and he put me in the car, and, you know, downtown we go. And I remember asking him, because I didn't care, you know. I mean, I just knew I didn't want to go to prison. I just didn't want to suffer the consequences, you know. And I just told him, I said, look, I can't afford another DUI. You know, whatever you want to do, we can work it out. It'll be okay. Please, I cannot get in no more trouble. And he said, if you don't shut up, Miss Perry, I'm going to write you up for something else. So I just started boohooing and crying even more, you know. And I just went on down to the jail. So the next morning, I called my son. And he's, you know, 17, and I called him, and I told him where I was, and I asked him to come down and get me, and he got a friend to bring him down there to get me and go get the car out in impoundment, and that hadn't been the first time, and, you know, he's had a lot of good buddies in his life, and to the best of my knowledge, or at least he hasn't told me, you know, nobody's ever said anything bad to him, or maybe they've said it behind his back or mine, but, I mean, they've been there for him is what I'm trying to say. And so they came down there and they got me, and he got the car out, and we went home, and he was trying to get out of the door to go to school, and I went straight to the refrigerator because I needed a drink. And I had that much alcohol in the bottle. And I mean, you know, when you drink till 2 o'clock and you've been drinking since 4 when you got off from work, I mean, I physically needed a drink. And he just looked at me and he said, Mama, what are you doing? And I said, don't worry about it, Ryan. I'm going to be all right. And I just turned it up and started drinking because I was shaking and I needed a drink. And I got the telephone book out and started looking for the lawyer because I am always looking for the lawyer. And he had this look on his face like he just couldn't believe it. And out the door he went. And I got the lawyer on the phone and explained everything. And he was like, Kelly, you know, I've helped you out so many times. Sooner or later, there's going to come a point I can't do anything. You know, the evidence is there. I can't do nothing. I had to call the probation officer, you know, and I had a pretty nice probation officer, and he said, you know, I'll let you stay out on bond. I won't violate your probation unless you're found guilty of the felony. So I stayed out, kept working at that little bar, and somebody told me, you know, you might want to go to one of these treatment centers so that they can help you out with the judge when you go to court. So I was like, well, you know, just anything, you know. I got to get help, you know. I got to do something. So I went over to Pathways Treatment Center, and they wanted me to come in for 28 days, but I couldn't do that. I still had to do it my way because I had to have the job for the work release. I had to have the aftercare. You see, my mind, I'm never going to do what you say. It's always got to be on my terms because I've always got to figure it out, you know. And they didn't go to court with me, and they didn't do any of them things. But I did start going to the aftercare, and I started telling them the truth. They tell you in them little groups, have you had a drink? Yeah. Well, we don't do that in here. You go on back, you come back for another little group, and they'd ask if anybody'd have a drink, and I'd say, yeah. And, you know, they want you to be honest, so I did. And then she said, next time you come in here and you say you've had a drink, I'm going to order you in here for 28 days. So, shoot, I didn't say no more about having no more drinks after then. Because, you know, I needed that job. Anyway, they introduced me. I'm going to tell you what, I have nothing bad to say about a treatment center because the one I went to did believe in the 12 steps, and they did take me to some AA meetings, which is where I met a girl there that started taking me to some AA meetings. But anyway, long story short, my first AA meeting, this lady, you know I've gotten ahead of myself, took me to my first AA meeting, and I want to just touch on this real quick. This woman come and got me to go to a 10 o'clock meeting when I was hungover, because I was thinking I had to get there because they were going to help me, you know. And we went to the Gateway down on Church Street in Lynchburg, and I rolled up in front of that place with that woman, and I seen these guys out there, and I looked at me, and I looked at them, and I knew I want nothing like them. And she said, get out of the car. And she's a pretty big woman, so I got out of the car. So the three guys out there, you know, I bummed a cigarette from, because I'm always bumming a cigarette. Most of us, when we get here, we ain't got nothing, so bumming a cigarette. You know, and they took me in the meeting, and they told me that everything would be okay. Let's just sit down here for a minute and let me get you a cup of coffee. And that's what they did. And when I sat down at that round table, I remember it like yesterday. I was shaken. I was full of fear. I was scared. It wasn't about being surrendered, and I never wanted another drink. But I had all that going on inside of me, the fear and the anxiety. But when I sat down at that table, and I just let out a breath, man, and I know it lasted the whole hour. I didn't hear what you said. but I felt what was in that room, and it was God and you people, and I felt safe. And if anybody comes to my home group or any of the meetings that I attend regularly in Lynchburg, I want you to feel safe. If you don't get nothing out of it, I want you to feel welcomed. I want you to feel safe, and I want you to know people love you and they're there, and I don't care what anybody else says. Because if you don't feel safe, you'll never come back. And if I'd have never got that feeling, I'd have never gotten to that next meeting. You know, if everybody in there had been needing a meeting and going crazy and whatnot like we do, I probably wouldn't have gotten to another meeting. So, I mean, people really reached out to me. They really reached out and really loved me, you know, when I was so unlovable. Because, you know, I was not lovable for a long time around here, really. So that started my journey into AA. And, you know, that lady asked me if I wanted to go to another meeting that night. No, but I was too scared to be by myself, so I went. Anyway, it's been a long journey for me here. I walked around in this program went to jail for 6 months. Because I want to get on to the recovery thing here. I didn't get the penitentiary time because I didn't get the felony. That got reduced. And, you know, I got to get out of jail, actually, and go to my son's graduation while I was in Lynchburg City Jail. I got off of probation sitting in Lynchburg City Jail. And that stuff don't happen unless there's a higher power. You know, that does not happen. But one night, in the midst of my craziness, I fell to my knees and I asked God to help me with no reservation. And it's just my experience. And that was on a Wednesday. I had to go to court on Friday, and I hadn't heard anything from the lawyer. And Thursday, I got the call where this had been reduced, and this is what we've worked out, and blah, blah, blah. And I ended up with the civil court judge instead of the criminal court judge in the circuit court because he won't there. I mean, just things got placed. They got rearranged, you know. And it was because I know I meant business. But anyway, so I did that, got out, went to a few meetings, but I didn't have a solution. And so I drank again 4th of July weekend. And I had 4 beers thinking I was going to play in a pool tournament. Went to Myrtle Beach, come back, and I wanted to go to a pool tournament. And somebody handed me a beer, and I took it. And I thought I was going to drink a Coke. And 4 beers later, I had a moment of clarity, thank God. And I realized what I was doing. And I didn't have a buzz, nothing. And I just came to myself, and I was like, man, you're drinking when you don't want to be drinking. You didn't want to come here for the drink. And I don't know why, but I pushed it away, and I walked all the way home from that bar about 4 blocks away, and I cried all the way home, but I knew I was done, and I haven't had one since then. Now, I don't know why that physical craving didn't set in, and I didn't keep on, and I didn't get in that car, and I didn't do this, and I didn't do that. I don't know why. I mean, I guess it's God's grace. I don't know why. I can't explain it. Don't care. And I went back and picked up a white chip. And I've been on this journey, and it's been a wild journey for me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It really has. It really has. It's been wild. It's been happy. It's been fun. It's been not so fun. It's been different. Up in Lynchburg, you hear a lot, you know, don't take a drink and go to a meeting. You hear it a lot. And that's what I did. And that was all right. And I'd go to conventions, and I'd go over here, and I'd go over there. But I had this rage inside of me. I had this thing that I just, every time you talked about God, I left, you know, cuss you out, do whatever, up and down in the meeting, getting the coffee, do whatever, you know, just gritting it, coming here. And I just couldn't stand myself. And I got up one morning, and I knew that I was either going to have to take a drink or do something. But I didn't know what. But what I did, what I'd been doing all along, was I was picking that phone up, and I was going to them meetings, so that when that feeling came, or when that thought came, I was disciplined enough that I made that phone call first. And I made a phone call, and I told this person about where I was at, and they said, get ready for the meeting. And I got ready for the meeting, even though I didn't want to go. And they were asking me about this third step, you know, and how you been doing it, and what do you, and I said, I can't, you know, I can't do all that stuff that means. Well, what do you think it means? Well, I think it means you got to go to church, and you can't drink, and I mean, you can't smoke, and you can't do all of this and everything, and I can't be perfect. And they said, no, that's not what it means. It just means that you believe in something bigger and better and stronger than you out there. And you're going to turn your will over to the care of that. And if you don't have a God, you can use mine. But at that time, the AA group was my higher power. And I could comprehend that. That was all I had right there. Y'all were bigger than me. And so at that little small beginning, that's what I turned my will and my life over to, was the AA group, the meetings. You know, and then they told me, and by knowing that you did this, we're going to go on and we're going to go to this fourth step and we're going to start writing some of this stuff down. And I'm not going to go through the whole step process, but that's how I have been brought along since I've been here. And I know I've done all kinds of things wrong since I've been here, very imperfectly. But the one thing I have not done is I have not picked up that drink. And as long as I don't pick up a drink, I got a chance for all these other things to work themselves out. But if I pick up a drink, I don't know if I'll make it back here. I see a lot of young ones coming in and out. I don't know nothing about it, but I'm one that's got a lot of ego and pride, and I might not come in and get me no white chip. You know, I don't know. I just don't know, but I don't want to find out. And I just started hanging out with people that seemed like they were happy, joyous, and free when they talked from the podium. And in the beginning, that was some of the people that had 2 or 3 months. Because I couldn't understand what the 5, 10, 15, 20-year people. But the one over there that was talking about going here and doing that, and they had a month or 2 or 3 months, I'd be like, hey, how'd you do that? You know, and start talking to you about that, whether it be wrong or right. That was more tangible for me, you know, and just started calling people and just started coming to meetings and just started taking a few actions and just trudging this road and one step forward and one step back. And, you know, I just don't have time to go on and on. But I believe in this book, and I can't quote it, but I believe that we need to come here hopeless as Bill. Now, I was hopeless, but I didn't find that out really till I got here. But I know I was hopeless. I won't surrender. And I think unless I'm hopeless, or if I'm not hopeless and I still think I got another idea, I'm going to have to do all of those things until I don't have no more. Until I'm out of all of those ideas, I'm going to have to drink every drop I got coming to me. And I know that sounds rough. But until I'm out of answers and I ask somebody to show me how to get what they got, because I don't want to live this way anymore, I'm going to have to keep doing those things until I humble myself enough to do that. And I have been able to do that. So I've just kind of jumped in here with this thing after a while and got involved in service very early on. I really believe in service. I really believe in service. I really believe in strong home group. You know, where you can watch members in your home group. If you stay there long enough and you don't run around all these meetings, you know, you'll see people go through things and they don't leave, you know, or they don't kill each other or go back out and drink. You know, we all just get through it together, kind of like as a family. But if I don't get committed to at least one group or a couple of them and let somebody know who I am, then I'm just going to be out here floating all around, and I'm going to be crazy. You know, I need to see how people are living their lives different from me and that can show me how to do that, if that's what I want. Now, I mean, a lot of us, some of us don't want that. But I just know from the short period of time that I've been here, I've been able to work a regular job. I've been able to get married in sobriety. I've been able to have a career now. I've got a granddaughter I just spent time with that's 15 months old. That boy would have never let me get in that car with me and bring him up here from Florida. I would not trade none of that in to go out here tonight for a couple of drinks and a yoo-hoo, ha-ha, whatever, and all that crap still there in the morning. Because it's all going to be there in the morning. It might subside tonight. You might get that little euphoria thing going on, but all that stuff's going to be there in the morning, and then what am I going to do, you know? My problem is not taking a drink today, but I do have other problems, and they all start up here, and that's why I need a sponsor, and I need committed meetings. I take meetings into the women's jail over in Lynchburg and over in Bedford. I don't know what they get out of that meeting, but when I leave, I'm more rejuvenated than ever. You know, I know that, I believe that that's God's purpose for me. That's what I believe. And I like to hang out with those people that are trying to help other people. And like I said, I don't do it perfectly by no means, but I keep doing it. And I've been told that as long as I stay in this thing and I keep doing it, no matter what it looks like, it's always going to be better when I get to the other side. And I'm going to learn something out of it, and all of it is supposed to be of use to somebody else, whether I like that or not. It's all supposed to be useful to somebody else. You know, because that's really what we are here for, I believe, is to, you know, stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. You know, at least that's what I believe. I'm going through a little transition period right now, and I'm going to be quiet, but I've had a sponsor that I love to death for a good while in my home group. And I was told, you know, about a month and a half ago that, you know, his sponsor had told him that it was time for me and another person that he sponsored to be looking for a woman sponsor. And, you know, I didn't really like that. But, you know, I'm open to that. And they're still there for me. They're in my home group. They've just moved into a different role, into an advisory role. They're there. I still talk to them. It's nothing that's got to happen overnight, you know. But they're following their directions, you know. And I understand that, and I'm not mad, and I'm not leaving, and I'm not talking about people. And it ain't got nothing to do about hiring and firing, and nobody likes you, you know. It's just, you've gotten to this place now where I think that you're all right, and you need to be useful to other women. And this is what my sponsor says, and you, this, you know. And so in that process, you know, I've been looking at what that looks like. And I got to go to a conference a few weeks ago at Freedom from Bondage, which is a corrections conference. And at that conference, I was put in touch with a woman through somebody that I very much respect. And we're getting to know each other on the phone right now. And we're talking a whole lot. And I don't have to weigh what she says against somebody else. All I'm learning right now is, can you trust me? And can you do this? And can you call me? But because of who told me about them, I know they wouldn't steer me in the wrong way. And they're very much into correction work, you know, and they've been sober for a long time. And I got to trust some people here that know better than me. And if I'm going to ask somebody, what do you think, and direct me, then I got to take it on faith and see what happens. And that's where I'm at right now. And it's all right. It's all good, you know. It's just all good. And I come here and I share with y'all. If you're new here tonight, or you're still drinking, or you want another way of life, there is another way. There's directions in the first 164 pages. And I know some of us don't want to take them. But I will tell you that not taking a drink and just going to a meeting, for me, did not work. And since I've been here, I've also seen people with 30 years of sobriety blow their head off because they didn't want to take another drink, but they had no solution and they were miserable inside. But they never told nobody that because they had 30 years and they thought, how would I look if I tell somebody that? So I also don't believe that the newcomer is the most important in the room. We don't know who the most important in the room. It might be the old timer that's struggling that needs help in this room. And so I just encourage you to keep coming back. Get hooked up with somebody that's living a good life that you might want what they have, and ask them how they got it, you know. And it ain't going to happen overnight, but it will happen. Every time I have been ready to throw the towel in on this thing and say, screw it, something has showed up right then and there just to make me go one more step. Every single time. Every single time. Sponsor has said, you never know where God's going to show up. Do the action, and you never know. You know, pray, go to meetings, help other alcoholics, keep your commitments, and things will happen. And, I mean, things have really happened for me. They really have. You know, I owe everything that's good and decent in my life today to Alcoholics Anonymous and to my God. And I came here with a different plan. I won't surrender. I came to manipulate you once again. And I don't think it matters how we get here or how we come in here or what or by what form. As long as we find out if we're a real alcoholic and we stay. That's the only thing. So I want to thank Billy and I want to thank Lynn and thank y'all for having me up here. Thanks.